Hey guys, this is your host, Doug Stewart. And if you have been with us since episode one, I want to thank you for hanging in there with us and being a loyal supporter and a loyal listener. We have so many episodes. I mean, we're in the mid to high 300s right now, depending on which episode you're listening to this little pre-roll for. What we're going to do is we're going to actually re-release a few of the episodes that I would consider maybe our greatest hits, ones that maybe you haven't listened to in a long time because you've been here with us from the beginning, or maybe you haven't actually been here for that long and you haven't had time to go back and re-listen to some of them. So we're going to reissue some of the episodes that were really, really, I'm going to call them old as in like they were recorded a long time ago, but they're not old in terms of relevancy. And so you'll hear from me as host. You'll also hear from probably Norman Horn as host. We might even have some other special guest hosts depending on what the topic is. So to be sure, we will also be releasing new episodes, but we also wanted to return to some of the classics that we've had. So I'll let you get to the show.
Welcome to the show that gets Christians thinking about faith and politics. Get ready to challenge the status quo, expand your imagination, and tackle controversy head on. Let's stand together at the intersection of faith and freedom. It's time for the Libertarian Christian Podcast.
Welcome to another episode of the Libertarian Christian Podcast, a project of the Libertarian Christian Institute. I'm Doug Stewart, and today I am joined by a special guest, Deirdre McCloskey. Deirdre McCloskey taught at the University of Illinois at Chicago from 2000 to 2015 in economics, history, English, and communications. She is a well-known economist and historian and rhetorician and has written at least 17 books and around 400 scholarly pieces on a wide range of topics, including a three-volume series on the bourgeois era. She joins us today to talk about bourgeois values, equality, capitalism, and the intersection of faith and libertarianism. And I'm sure we'll get to a whole lot of other questions and discussions. Deirdre, thanks for joining us.
Well, I'm glad to be here, dear.
When I reached out to you, I felt fortunate that I got a response saying you were able to join us because our mutual friend, Dr. Art Carden, says that you've been gallivanting around the world speaking about the bourgeois virtues.
Certainly.
So has the world improved because you've been doing this? I mean, is it catching on yet?
I don't think so. You know, there's this very strong feeling in what I call the clerisy, the intellectuals and the professors and the journalists and so forth, that being bourgeois is just a terrible thing. And to add to that, sincere, especially progressive Christians believe that it's unholy as well to be in the business world. And they believe that capitalism is fundamentally corrupting and so on and so forth. I don't think that's true, but it's very hard to change people's minds.
It certainly is. Of course, we don't, you know, Libertarian Christian Institute, I mean, hello, we're ardent capitalists promoting people here. We don't think it's true either. This year, I've actually heard two people, friends of mine who would be considered on the left. I don't think either of them are Christians, but they have used the term bougie as a short term. And it's interesting to me that they would use that because they would describe it in a way that was like, there's this little bit of endearment to it, as if it's not quite so bad anymore. And I wonder if that's like, maybe there's a shift, like bougie isn't so bad, but we're just going to use that term.
Well, you know, the sort of underlying problem is that your friends are probably in the false position of being anti-bourgeois while being bourgeois.
I can confirm for you that that is truly the case for the two people I have in mind, yeah.
Of course, more and more people are no longer in blue-collar occupations, and even upper blue-collar people are bourgeois. And it's kind of psychologically sad for them to have this self-doubt and self-hatred. So maybe that's why they're being so cute.
Yeah. Well, what do you mean by bourgeois? Because I think a lot of people have this sort of idea, and it seems that the word middle class isn't quite accurate, even though that might be the best non-French sounding word.
Sure. As a matter of fact, in English, they used the French word bourgeois before the word middle class was used very commonly. The word middle class, the phrase didn't come into wide use in England until the 1800s. Whereas in the early 1700s, it was common to speak of the middling sort, which was the more common phrase, as being the same as the French bourgeois. All it means, actually, is urban dweller of the middle class. If you're rural dweller of the middle class, you're called gentry. And so The important point is that in the 1700s, and much more so in the 1800s, people stopped thinking of being middle class as lower and stupid. Well, there was kind of a split because, as I said, the clerisy went off in this direction of attacking people in business. But most of the people in the society, and I'm speaking of England and even France and the United States and Germany, became less scornful, at least, of the middle class and the bourgeoisie. And in particular, they stopped attacking the system in which they worked, innovism. They stopped hating it and started to admire innovation. So altogether, it worked out very well for the rest of us.
Yeah, I want to talk about the word innovation a little bit, but there's something that when I was reading, I forget which of your three books on the bourgeois era, I was reading it and somebody was at a reunion once and somebody come up and said, you know, what are you reading? What is it about? And I'm like, well, goodness, this is, you know, 3 inches thick. So my go-to thought was a little pop quiz and asking them how much has the world improved since 1800? And I'll let you tell that because what everybody thinks is that we were all happy and equal and we were just so, you know, we were one with the earth, all of that 200 years ago, and our soul has been ripped away by factories and industrial. Anyway, what's the rest of the week?
We were one with the earth. We were eating it. We were sick all the time. We died.
Or in it.
We were in it. We were in the mud. Think of Monty Python version of the Middle Ages. It was just terrible. And since then, since around, say, 1800, when average income in the world as a whole was about, in current terms, about $3 a day, it's now $30 a day, even including the very poor countries. I mean, per person. So it's increased per person by a factor of 10. That's 1,000%. And indeed, in the countries like Finland or Japan or the United States that have taken full advantage of this bourgeois revaluation and what I call the great enrichment, it's more like a factor of 30. I was in the University of Cambridge a couple of weeks ago speaking to anthropologists about this and got into a funny discussion with a very famous anthropologist. I won't use his name because it's embarrassing. I said it's a factor of 30, and then I switched to saying 3,000%. And he stood up and said, "I agree with 30. But I think you're exaggerating when you say 3,000%. And I had to be very gentle with this guy. He's a very distinguished Cambridge anthropologist. His name I won't give. But so it's 3,000%. And in earlier times, doublings from time to time, 100% would happen. Although in every earlier episode, the world reverted to $3 a day, wherever it was, China, Europe, wherever. But after 1800, it hasn't reverted. It's gone up, up, up. We've had in the United States about 40 recessions since 1800. And in every case, income per head after the recovery has been higher than the previous peak. So peak to peak, it goes up and up and up and up. And this is transformative. It's now happening on a big scale at a much lower level to start with in China and India and lots of other countries. And indeed, worldwide, things like infant mortality is falling like a stone. Life expectation is rising, even in very poor countries. People are moving out of what the great Hans Rosling, the Swedish professor of public health, calls stage one. They're moving to either two or three or even four.
Yeah.
So it's a tremendous change. And that's why I call it the great enrichment.
You know, when I ask people that question, you know, how good do you think the world has gotten in the last 200 years? Usually the highest estimate I've ever heard somebody say is it's doubled.
Yeah.
And that always would be good, I suppose.
It is good. I'm in favor. You know, boy, if you or I could double our incomes, we'd be delighted. But it's way, way above that. And that's actually a point that Hans Rosling makes, that people don't realize how much better the world has become, even in the last 30 years. inequality, for example, which people are terribly worried about. If you look at inequality worldwide, sort of person by person, it's fallen sharply in the last 30 years. It hasn't risen. If you look at the number of people getting along, if that's quite the word, on $2 a day, imagine trying to live in Chicago or wherever, on $2 a day, that's fallen like a stone. It's now quite a small percentage of the total world population. So, you know, it's as though we're trapped in the 1960s and we're being told that the world is coming to the end because population is growing. And we've never gotten over that. The third world people talk about is rapidly disappearing.
Yeah. I mean, we've seen tremendous growth. I mean, a lot of those gains have been in India and China. And I know you're predicting Africa is very close in coming to its own enrichment.
In the last 10 years, sub-Saharan Africa has started to grow.
Yeah. What is your, I have not heard somebody from the progressive left, Christian or non, give an alternate explanation for this, because, you know, obviously they're going to focus on inequality. And to me, that's a distraction. But what they do is they say, well, the improvement and the explanation that Hans Rosling, because I've sent the videos that Hans Rosling has done, you know, he has this graph and it's the hockey stick graph and he maps and all that. And they're like, well, that's just one little part of it. And there's all sorts of other things, you know, and they'll bring up a few government, you know, related programs like, you know, the New Deal or unions or that kind of stuff. But I have never heard a comprehensive explanation as to why are we wealthy? Why are we so much better off that even conforms to their typical suggestions on how life ought to be in the marketplace?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. It's a very strange phenomenon. I have lots of very intelligent friends on the left, and this is a tremendous hole in their argument. They'll say that, as you said, they'll say things like, well, the trade union movement made us rich. Well, trade unions have been declining in the United States for 40 years, so that can't be it. Since we've continued to grow, contrary to the statement you often hear. And you know what? Our trade unions in China, why they're growing? I can assure you that the Communist Party doesn't allow any trade unions. And there are a whole bunch of sort of crazy ideas in the back of their heads. Let's take France, for example, a country I admire very much. But the French left thinks that these bosses, these capitalists, have this pile of money, gold, in the back room, and that the employees, that is, the workers, can keep demanding more of it. and it's a completely crazy idea, and the magnitudes are wrong. Mm-hmm. Suppose the bosses had a pile of gold in the backyard room, and you were going to extract more by going on strike or protesting or increasing the minimum wage or something. That would only explain maybe, I don't know, a 20% increase in wages if you got all the gold, or say 100%. But that's why it's so important to understand the 3,000% or the 1,000% that we're trying to explain. And if you face up to that scientific fact, and it is a scientific fact, you can nibble away at the edges, but in fact, improve quality of goods and services since 1800 or 1900. Makes it even higher than 3,000%. 3,000% is not properly correcting for improved quality of medicine and, for that matter, economics.
Well, and it is that the sort of thing that you're saying that you can't measure the fact that, you know, 200 years ago, it's either a horse, transportation by carriage or your feet, whereas now it's a Tesla versus a Honda Civic?
That's right. Or indeed, you can think of much more radical changes. Lighting is one that's been measured fairly well. I mean, now we turn on a switch and we've got massive numbers of candle powers going in our houses all the time. And in 1800, you were reduced to tallow candles, or actually you You went to sleep at dark if you were poor. And medicine in 1800, they bled George Washington when he was sick and they killed him. So what's the improvement of medicine since 1900? So there, and those are very hard to measure in a way to deflate them, if you know what I mean, to get down to what the real effect is. And it's very large, and I think it's actually getting larger. Take a look at your cell phone someday and think of the point that you don't have to buy a flashlight anymore.
Yeah.
No one has any flashlights because they don't need them. They have them in their cell phone.
Yeah.
And so it goes. So then what people say, and this is a kind of a background, or not a background, a backstop, is that we're spiritually corrupt. And if that were so, I would agree with my friends on the left and some on the right. In fact, many on the right who say that, we've gained the world, but we've lost our immortal soul. And if that were true, I'd be appalled by modern economic growth. But I would argue that it's the other way around. There's materialism, and there are people who don't see that their soul and God is more important than the newest cell phone. But in fact, on the whole, you're able to pursue the transcendent more seriously if your stomach isn't aching from hunger.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think there's a little bit of irony. Maybe you would agree that the people who are on the left, declaring that we're losing our soul because of this, corrupting system and so forth. Yeah, they're the ones that are there. Yeah. Well, consumerism, which isn't capitalism. And yet they're the ones who are so worried about the material well-being of those who have very little. I mean,
Yeah, that's right. That's exactly right. And it's and I'm concerned about it, too. I want the poor to be better off. But the poor actually are better off. And the engine of better offness is not Christian charity. Not that I'm against Christian charity. I think it's very good for the souls of the people who give it. And I want to ask Thomas Piketty, if I ever debate him, where he put the royalties from his great book about inequality. Did he give them to the poor? I doubt very much he did.
Yeah.
I tithe at my church. I had two homeless people in my house for 4.5 years. Okay. That's my Christian duty to the poor. But my underlying Christian duty is to the world's poor. And I satisfy it by urging people to adopt this innovism, to accept the bourgeois deal, as I call it. You let me bourgeois invent something or improve automobiles or something, and I'll make you rich. That's the deal. Not bad. And it does not corrupt one's soul. It doesn't have to.
No. No, I mean, you've talked about the poor have been the primary beneficiaries of modern capitalism. They're the ones who need it.
Exactly. Come on. And I think this is a very strong point. Obviously, Lilian Betancourt, who's the heiress of the L'Oreal cosmetic fortune, is a terrible jerk. And she's the richest woman in the world. She gets from economic growth an extra diamond bracelet, but the poor person gets a roof over her head or enough food or an opportunity for her children to go to school. So the change in the real condition of the poor from 1800 and 1900, or for that matter, 1950 to the present, has been just dramatic.
Yeah. Well, you wrote in one of your books, you said that it's the beneficiaries of modern capitalism, that is the poor, is obscured by the first act of the wealth going to the bourgeoisie.
That's right.
Which, that's okay, right. Fine. So, you know, I'll make you rich. The bourgeois deal is eventually I'll make you rich. What's happening in the meantime? Because that's where I think the resentment ends up coming through. And you're right, it's obscured. So where's this heading?
Well, the key thing is entry. If the rich are able to corrupt the government to prevent entry, and they try to, there's no doubt about that, then the gain doesn't go to poor people. But if other capitalists or other entrepreneurs or other business people can imitate the success, then it does accrue to the poor. I was arguing at lunch with a friend of mine about Walmart, and she hates Walmart, as so many people on the left do. And I tried to persuade her, I didn't make much headway, that Walmart has been very good for poor people. And it's true that the low margins, some of the low margins in retailing are going to the Walton children, who apparently are not wonderful. Okay, but in the meantime, poor people get to go to Walmart and buy stuff that they need at very low prices. And it's funny because she admitted that Walmart was very good at that, that it was giving poor people good stuff at low prices. And I tried to convince her that that was a good thing. No, she says they're monopolists and they don't pay their people enough. Actually, it turns out that Walmart pays people more than comparable department stores or grocery stores. That's actually a fact. So it's very hard to change people's minds on this, but it is, I keep trying.
Yeah, well, you know, that's kind of our goal too at LCI is to, you know, help people, especially Christians, make the case that this stuff is one, it's more complicated than a simple meme or headline that you see scroll across your social media is. But second, it takes time to discuss this kind of thing with people.
Yeah, it does.
So, you know, only so often can a witty comment help them see the light.
Yeah, I know. And I know this. I've had the same experience myself. I started as a socialist when I was 16. I was thought of myself as an anarchist socialist. The old joke is that if you're not a socialist by age 16, you have no heart. If you're still socialist at 26, you have no brain. And I'm just made it on both scores.
Yeah.
Just slipped in there.
The latest trick to demonize Walmart and, for that matter, Amazon with the Sanders proposal, the Bezos Act, or whatever it was there, is that they're double dipping because, one, they don't pay their employees enough, and then, therefore, they suggest that they go get government services, and then those same employees use the government services to go back to Walmart. So,
I was arguing. That's the thing that got my friend at lunch got started. She retailed. This Bernie argument to me, and an answer occurred to me that the great advantage of being an economist and a historian is that talking to lay people actually can be very enlightening because you think of you get no ideas. Whereas if you're a chemist and people don't understand H2O, there's nothing you can do about it. You're kind of stuck with the elementary things. But anyway. Here's the point. If that's true of, say, Amazon and Walmart, why isn't it true of every business in the United States? If, say, you own a small independent hardware store, why don't you say, look, guys, you can only work 17 hours a week. And then you should go to the government and get welfare. It's got, yeah, you see, the argument, if true, it's not true, but if true, it's too powerful in a manner of speaking because it applies to everyone. And there's no reason at all to blame Walmart or Amazon for this. Now, the fact of the matter is that it's not true. people are paid at Walmart what that kind of worker earns in the rest of the economy, period. Earns, and earns in all respects. That is, if Walmart doesn't pay health insurance, then the workers will supply themselves at a slightly higher wage only because they've compared with a place where they can get health insurance. The wage at Walmart will have to be slightly higher to compensate for that. And it's very hard to argue against this point because it's just rather obvious that if people are being abused at Walmart, they will leave and go somewhere else. They'll go to some other job. And Walmart, and especially Amazon, are a tiny part of the labor market. This is a very, let's talk of all the unskilled people in the United States. Well, not completely unskilled. They can read and so forth. But on the whole, unskilled people work at Walmart. And they can go work at McDonald's and thousands of other jobs. And because they can move, because these aren't slave societies we're talking about, at least at the margin, the people who get angry at working at Walmart and feel they're being abused, they'll move, and then Walmart's going to have to pay people more to attract. So the whole business, the attack on Walmart, is crazy. And I'm glad you brought it up because that's the argument against capitalism, that the workers are being exploited and so on. Yeah, they're being exploited and their income is going up by a factor of 30.
Hey, folks, if you love listening to our podcast, you may want to check out our monthly webinars. Every month, we have a different speaker take a deeper dive into topics relevant to libertarian Christians. If you've missed some of our webinars so far, well, don't worry. You can still download them. Visit our website at libertarianchristians.com/events. And now let's get back to the show.
Yeah, I can imagine that the leftist who might stumble upon this conversation and hear what you just said might consider it a little heartless to say, well, they'll just move and find a different job because that's not always an option. And I think what you're describing, that this competitive nature of the market and the pressure that other firms will put on Walmart and offer better conditions, it's not something that happens overnight. We're dealing with, what could possibly be several years or a decade worth of progress.
No, it happens overnight because it happens at the margin.
Yeah.
That is, it only takes, 5% of the workforce to be outraged and move to another job to bring pressure to bear on the employer who is abusing her employees. It's not heartless. It's how the world works. If the price of milk is 2 times higher at the convenience store than it is at the grocery store, and they're equal distances, the convenience store is not very convenient, you go to the grocery store. Mm-hmm. And this kind of entry and exit is the heart of a free society. If you want to choose your religion, you can move. If you don't like Judaism or Catholicism, come become an Episcopalian like me. This moving business is not a bad thing. We move in music tastes. If some band is one that most people don't like, it won't prosper. People move away from it. So movement is religiously, artistically, economically necessary for a free society. So it's not as if these people are being exploited. They're not being exploited. We've all been in a situation where we've been grumpy about our pay. I have, for sure. But as an economist and as a liberal Christian, as a Christian who believes in free will and the freedom that people can exercise in a free society and not in a communist or a fascist society, I'm not impressed by this argument that, we've got to fix it right now on the job. You can sort of see what the socialist alternative is to bring in the government, to force Walmart to pay higher prices. I mean, pay higher wages. And, you know, that as though Springfield Washington could do a better job than a free society of people moving around can do.
Yeah, I often will wonder why, if it's so easy to just simply have a better business model and pay your workers better, which some people do pursue, then why isn't there a massive move on the left to be the owners of these businesses? It's not like Jeff Bezos is giving money to the Republican Party or like...
That's right.
It's... A lot of the world's wealthy who have quote unquote too much money are all leftists too. Not all of them, but a lot of them.
I proposed to my friend at lunch that she and I set up a consulting company to tell all these other businesses that apparently don't realize what Walmart and Amazon, this scam that they're running on the welfare system. And we could make a lot of money to saying to every every employee in Chicago, look, hey, you pay us $1,000 in consulting fees and we'll double your profits. Well, you know, it doesn't happen. Her answer was relevant for a Christian. She said, I wouldn't do that because it's unethical. And then she said that Walmart and Amazon and so on are greedy. And I tried to point out to her that anyone who buys a dress is greedy. And if what you mean by greed is pursuing your advantage in a legal way.
Yeah.
And no, she wouldn't have any.
Well, somehow it's not greedy that all these workers want 50 cents more or a dollar more. Like, wait a second. I realize that, yes, your life would be on the margins better than the person who has a lot. But it's only greed when you have a lot of money to start with that doesn't follow.
Yeah, exactly right. And greed is a sin. I'm against greed.
Yeah.
And I understand greed to be prudence, namely finding the dress you want for a good price or paying your workers what they can earn elsewhere, and not more. That's prudence without other virtues. If you have just prudence, then you're, as economists are often say, if all that matters is prudence, that's the only virtue. Then, and you don't have love or justice or hope, faith, courage, temperance, then that's greed. So it's this unbalanced quality of the pursuit of profit that is properly called greed and is something bad. And it is so corrupting. But I don't think ordinary economic behavior, as I said before, I don't believe ordinary economic behavior is so corrupting. And I'm trying to persuade my... socialist friends and what's disturbing is that they're very willing to go to the government as though the government were not soul corrupting. And there's a great danger in the instruments that the government uses. I'm not against all government, and I think there's a role for government. But the problem is that the basic instrument government has is compulsion, is the threat to put you in jail. The police, the IRS, you know, so what do you want? Do you want a society where people are not slaves and free to move? Or do you want a society in which some person in some government office is compelling you to do this or that?
Yeah. Well, and you also ought to be suspicious of the actions the government takes when you have the ultra wealthy rallying behind it for certain measures to be taken, because there's probably not something good going on back there.
Absolutely. There's a tremendous... Charles Koch is often attacked on the left as a terrible man. But in fact, he's against corporate welfare. And he really is. He doesn't just say it. He puts his money where his mouth is, and he's got a lot of money.
Yeah.
And he's against the very corporate welfare that would make him better off.
Yeah.
But there's a more deep point here, which is that this free society that we, on the whole, have, I think we shouldn't exaggerate how prevalent compulsion and socialism is in our lives. We're free to go, you know, buy the dress there, go out of Walmart and go somewhere else. This free society has a correlate in Christian life and theology, and that is free will. God so loved the world that he gave us free will. And free will has to be free. You have to be able to choose sin. If God were to arrange things that we didn't ever sin, that is, we didn't have the choice of going the wrong way, then we wouldn't really have free will. So choice and the ability to go this way or that, as opposed to being guided along the path of virtue. If are we pets of God,
mm-hmm.
or are we God's children, whom He wants? She actually wants us to. She wants us to have a full life of choice. So there's a deep homology, there's a deep formal similarity between the theology of free will on the one hand and the economics of a free society on the other.
Yeah, I think the freedom, the free to choose. I mean, the scripture is just, it's all over the place. You know, choose this day whom you will serve. You know, come and follow me. You know, Jesus didn't drag people along. You know, I mean, he had fishing nets and he didn't grab them and drag them along.
That's right.
So I want to divert for just a second. You referred to God in a female pronoun, and
of course,
go ahead and explain.
Well,
explain that.
I'm a progressive Episcopalian. So
okay,
my God is a black female single mother from the Caribbean. Overweight, middle-aged, who lives in Leeds and works at the local grocery store. So all you guys ought to get ready because he's going to be there when you go through the pearly gates. I think, to be quite serious about it, the character of God, you know, just can't be confined to an old man with a beard. We're made in God's image, and we're made in all kinds of ways. Fat, thin, black, white,
yeah.
Old, young, straight, gay. So let's be more calm about the character of God.
In Genesis, when God made Eve a helper, you know, the word there is actually used, that word is used throughout the rest of the Old Testament to describe God in relationship to Israel.
Is it really? Well, that's nice. I like that.
Yeah. So there are a lot of, you know, truth be told, there are a lot of characteristics and qualities, despite the overwhelming majority of male.
Oh yeah.
You know, the 100% male authorship of the Old Testament.
Yeah.
That we can tell. There's an overwhelming number of times where God is referred to in motherly and feminine,
yeah.
and feminine attributes. So that's not really in dispute.
Sure.
I just wanted to kind of go rabbit trail.
I often call myself a sisterly libertarian. My way of talking about it is the two versions of the Golden Rule. Hillel of Babylon, the late first century BCE Jewish sage, put it in negative terms. He said, do not do unto others as you would not want them to do to you. And that's like the non-aggression principle. It's kind of a male, leave me alone
yeah.
way of putting it. Whereas Jesus, an early first century CE person, put it in the positive way. Don't pass by on the other side. Be a good Samaritan. Do unto others as you have them do unto you. And I think we need both. I think we need Hillel's version and Jesus's version, because Hillel's version resists oppression and interference, ignorant interference in other people's lives, which I certainly approve of. Whereas Jesus's version opposes a kind of heartless, I'm all right, Jack, attitude of not caring for other people. We need both the male and the female principles here.
I want to switch to capitalism and the term. You've used the word innovism here and in your writings. You know, at LCI, we have our core values and we include the word capitalism. In fact, we had a little bit of internal debate over whether or not we wanted to use the word capitalism. Is it too far gone? And so we wrestled with that as an organization and we came out with, you know, we're gonna go ahead and use it because it's the best word we have. It's worth remaining and it's worth recovering despite, you know, common misperceptions about it. But you try not to use that word as much as possible, although I think for your audiences, you tend to use it because that's what they know. They know you're talking about it. But
yeah,
you've got trade-tested betterment. You've got innovism.
Yeah.
What can we?
Market societies, et cetera, et cetera. And but the reason to avoid it is not its bad connotations, because you notice I don't avoid bourgeois.
Fair. Yeah.
Even though it's got more or less the identical bad association. So it's not quite that, although of course I understand that problem. It's that it's scientifically misleading because it suggests, as the blessed Adam Smith believed, and as Marx believed, and as many modern economists believe, that capital is the initiating force in the society, and that accumulation of capital is what market society or this trade-tested, commercially tested betterment is all about. And that's false. That's plainly false. And I can give you 500 pages of evidence on the point, because capital is just piling brick on brick or bachelor's degree on bachelor's degree. And without new ideas, the new bricks or the new bachelor's degrees are going to fall on fallow ground. It's like the parable of the mustard seed. If it falls on stony ground, it won't flourish. It's the ground, it's the ideas that matter. And so what we should be focusing on is a liberalism, a Christian liberalism, as I call it, that gives the that gives people permission to have ideas, economic ideas, to open a hairdressing salon when it's needed in the neighborhood, or to invent the air brakes on the railways, or whatever. So it's crucial to get away from the idea that pouring capital into a community or an economy is how you make it grow. It's just not true. It's true that capital is necessary, but so are lots of things necessary. I don't know, oxygen in the air, the existence of a labor force. I mean, come on, there are an infinite number of necessary things.
Yeah.
But the initiating force is new ideas. And what's extraordinary about the last two centuries is the astounding number of mechanical, biological, organizational ideas we've had.
Yeah, it's mind-boggling to me to think of an era where the existence of innovation and new ideas or new, you know, simpler ways to, you know, better ways to farm. I mean, I live in Amish country and I get to watch my literal neighbors do things on the farm that I'm like, you know, I don't even have to give you something that's mechanical. I could probably improve the tool you're using just by, you know, curving it a little bit or doing something like that. And it's hard to imagine that at some point in our history as humans, that was looked down upon.
You know, that is a nice analogy. I lived close to Amish people in Iowa, in eastern Iowa. And, you know, there are the steel tire Amish and the rubber tire Amish and this and that. And I don't look down on them, but you're right. There's a kind of a well, in their case, they're at some theologically based resistance to some kinds of innovation. So actually, they're very willing to have innovation in horse breeding. But, you know, it's like what Henry Ford was asked, what he thought his customers wanted before the coming of the automobile. And he said, a faster horse.
Yeah.
And you're perfectly right that there's a big change, which you can see in all kinds of ways, in all parts of the society of Northwestern Europe, in attitudes towards innovation. I mean, as I point out somewhere in the books, the very word innovation was a bad word really until the 19th century. You can follow its history in the Oxford English Dictionary. Note that before the 19th century, it was about changes in church doctrine, mainly. And innovism was a bad thing. My word, you're changing our belief system. What a terrible idea. But by the 19th century, it started to be used in this positive way that we've become so accustomed to. In fact, now innovation is kind of a buzzword, and everyone approves of it, and isn't it grand? That wasn't true in the 17th century.
Yeah, I mean, our culture lives and breathes innovation. I mean, even people on the left love innovation. I mean, look at Silicon Valley. They're not a bunch of, you know, hardened conservatives.
They think that science is the source of their innovation. And they're, my friend Joel Mulcair thinks this, although he and I agree on an awful lot. And I just don't think that's right. I think you need a free society, a society in which the promise of Christianity or the Abrahamic religions generally, that God is setting us free to fall on our faces or to reach for glory. One way or the other, we're free. We aren't pets. We aren't slaves.
One of the recent books that I've read is by Jonah Goldberg, Suicide of the West, and he says he relies heavily on your work on capitalism. I don't know if you've gotten to read it or not, but
I haven't, though. I'm very favorably disposed towards him. When I see his columns in the newspaper, I read them, and they're ordinarily they're very insightful.
Yeah, well, he and I think Matt Ridley as well have one critique of your assessment of the great enrichment, and that is that social institutions that they're not getting their fair share of the credit. Have you been able to interact with them, you know, off the page, or what's your response to them?
Yeah, I've spoken to Jonah a bit, and I'm reasonably close to Matt. I see him a lot. I saw him a few weeks ago at a conference, and I've eaten a couple of times with him in the House of Lords. Did you know that he's a Viscount? he's an aristocrat.
Yes, I did know that. Yeah.
Yeah, his family have been servants of the king since the 16th century. Well, lots of people say to me that institutions are where it's at, and there are a number of problems with this, and through the last two of the books, I attack institutionalism, and I've attacked it in other essays that aren't in the two volumes. But just in summary, one basic problem is that institutions are usually conservative, so they're not innovative. That's one problem. The second problem is most of the institutions of Northwestern Europe didn't change in the crucial eras between the, say, the 17th century and the 20th century. There's a lot of great sluggishness in the institutions. And look, the United States had to fight a great civil war to get rid of one of those institutions. And in any case, the institutions wouldn't do it unless there was a surrounding atmosphere of liberty. Indeed, if you continued with slavery and the subordination of women and the subordination of poor men, as you know, in the early days of our country, poor men in lots of states weren't allowed to vote. If that amount of hierarchy had continued, we would not have had this expansive economy. So the basis of the institutions, you see, changing to the extent, small extent they did, was ethics, a change in attitudes towards other people. It's unless you define institutions as all social customs, in which case it's a pathology, the institutions are not where it's at.
Well, Goldberg's argument, and he's specifically defending the United States, the growth in the United States and some of the things, is that the magic, I don't think he uses the word magic, but I'll just use that here. The magic in what happened was that these institutions, these social customs and institutions, broadly speaking, were written down. In fact, I think that's the phrase he says, what the beauty of the American Revolution is that they wrote these ideas down and confirmed them in, you know, actual documents that defined what America was. And that's where he kind of places it.
That's fair enough. But I think he's referring more to the Constitution.
Yes.
Than the Declaration of Independence. And that's maybe the difference between Jonah and me. Because
I think he's referring to both. If I recall, I read the book twice this year, so I should remember. But
okay, good. I mean, then if I should read the book, but I haven't got time really. But that's a stupid thing to say. I have got time. I'll find time to read.
Well, he reads the audiobook, and it's wonderful to listen to. So you can give that a go.
I should try it. But it's all men are and women, dear, are created equal. That's the central idea of liberalism. The American Constitution is a fine document, and I admire it very much, particularly the First Amendment to it. But it's not a liberal, put it this way, it's a structure of governance, which is what it's supposed to be. It's not an idea of equality. And the essential message of Abrahamic religions is that all souls are equal. And this is not true in Hinduism, for example. And it's an extremely powerful idea that didn't really mean anything socially until it was the ante was raised in the 18th century, in 18th century liberalism, in this idea that, and it kept being cashed in again and again and again. Gay rights. The right to marry between gays. That campaign really took off when people started to realize that it was just another case of equality. That's all. So it's equality that matters. This is something that Tocqueville said, of course, about the United States. It's the desire for equality, which in the sort of Rousseau version leads to socialism, and in the Adam Smith version leads to a free market society.
In your book, Bourgeois Equality, you write that the ethical object should be the level of a poor person's situation and not her rank. And I have a lot of, you know, left-leaning friends, or very, not even left-leaning, like they don't lean anywhere other than they're there. they're not leaning left, they are left.
They're
not leaving, and they're very intelligent. But they put a value on relative
it could be relative poverty, but I think the better way of describing it might be that there is a gap of equality, and global equality is down, as you mentioned earlier. But then we have some statistics that the gains of trade since the 80s have largely gone to those who are the, you know, the quote unquote greedy capitalists and all of this. And,
yeah.
You know, what I asked one of my friends, who is probably the smartest person I know, who's a pretty good defender of progressivism from a Christian perspective, at least of my friends. And his kind of response to me was that studies show that happiness is connected to a sense of social cohesion rooted in a strong sense of fair play, and that those factors impact wealth inequality, so that like higher degrees of inequality lead to less happiness. Also, at the rich to buy themselves, and it becomes
I've heard this story.
So what's your... You're sitting with lunch with somebody when they say stuff like that. What do you respond with?
I say you don't want equality to be your moral guide here, because you're encouraging envy. You're encouraging the sin of envy. Don't covet your neighbor's goods or husband's or anything else. Is it the ninth commandment? I forget, or the eighth, something like that. And it does seem to me that this obsession with equality and the constant talking about it is based on an idea that we should be envious of people who are rich. And I think what we should be preaching is not, oh dear, you're justified in feeling angry at the rich person next door. We should be preaching, don't covet your neighbor's goods. Shut up and be a Christian yourself. So I'm highly doubtful that this constantly quoted assertion that Bernie Sanders got, in practically in every speech he mentions it, that as you said, most of the gain in the last 30 years has gone to the top 1% or 2% or 10% or whatever they have in mind. That's false, because the real gain, as I said before, is often in the quality of goods. And if real wages, as calculated, are stagnant, they're not, but people are always saying it, but okay, let's go with it. The real ability to get stuff has increased. And you can, there are all kinds of evidences of this. Square feet of housing per capita has gone up in the last 30 years per person. The number of automobiles per capita has gone up. Take a look at TVs, so far as entertainment is concerned. They're vastly improved. Take a look at medical care. Even available to the poor, it's improved in quality. It's much better than it was. Some forms of cancer now are on the run. But all kinds of things have improved. So it's simply false to say what they say.
And another falsity is the concept of the top five or eight, the eight richest people in the world, quote unquote, control 50% of the wealth. Okay, so I know that that's false, but when it's laughable to even think that that's what people, I can't believe people think they quote unquote control. It's like they have a stockpile of cash.
Yeah.
It's all...
Yeah, I know. They're thinking of Scrooge McDuck.
Yeah.
I don't know if you know that.
Yeah.
Of course, with his steam shovels and piles of money and so forth. And this is a calculation that Oxfam does every year. Oxfam, that pillar of integrity. has been shown, the Oxfam operatives have been shown to solicit prostitution in the countries that they're working in. But okay, set that aside. Every year they calculate, Oxfam is an English charity, that the top, well, choose your number, the top 50 billionaires in the world, if their wealth was shared, they control, again, control, same word, more than the bottom, I don't know, 80% of the world or something like that.
Yeah.
And I've made a calculation. In fact, it is, I believe, somewhere in those three books, that if you took the money from all of them and handed it out to the others, it, of course, would improve the others a bit. But it's minuscule by comparison.
And it's a one-off gain.
It's a one-off gain. It can't be repeated because the same people aren't going to come. Carlos Slim in Mexico is not going to be come around to be milked again if you've expropriated him. But the magnitudes aren't enough to explain very much. I would wish that Carlos Slim would give all his money to the poor. I actually do wish that he would do that. I think it would improve his soul and would help the poor people a little bit. But what really helps them is to make the Mexican economy grow. And for that, you've got to do a lot of things that are much more important than attacking the rich.
Yeah, for sure.
Now, of course, if the there's a kind of addendum to that. If the rich are using their money to grossly corrupt politics for their advantage, then I object to it. I'm not in favor of crony capitalism.
Yeah, well, and it's too bad that that seems to be the MO of some of these capitalists. Like they innovate still, you know, it's like Amazon is a mixture. That's the trouble. It's like, this is all a mixture of both. And you have to really dig in to figure
that out. That's right. You have to dig in. And there are some of these billionaires who earn their money by working hard and innovating, say Bloomberg, right? Three times mayor of New York. He's a very rich man because he's an innovator. And then take Donald Trump, please, who's a rich man because he got much of it from his father, and then he cheated. And I don't approve of that. I'm not a worshiper of the rich. I am of innovators.
Yeah. Well, it's funny, when Donald Trump was boasting about his riches while he was running for office, suddenly all the leftists were becoming experts in opportunity costs, because apparently someone did the calculation. that had he just invested the money he inherited just from his father, he would have done better than all the businesses he did.
That's right.
On the margin. Right.
Well, he went bankrupt four times, and you know, all these. We're someday, if the House turns in this election in 2 weeks, we'll get to see Donald Trump's tax returns eventually.
Okay, yeah.
So, something to look forward to.
You know, you talk about something that I found interesting, and I hadn't really thought about it until I read one of your books about it, is the difference between consumptive equality versus just what we kind of talk about as inequality or material, you know, just immaterial or material inequality.
That's right. I haven't worked out a very good terminology for it, and I'd like some help on that. And consumptive won't do, because it means in some context it means having tuberculosis.
Oh.
but yeah, that's right. There's inequality of wealth, which is capital, capital stock at any one time. And then below that, there's inequality of income, which isn't the same thing and is more equally distributed than the capital. Okay, capital being claims to physical capital.
Right.
Now, as a matter of fact, human capital is much more equally distributed than claims to, you know, ownership of factories and so forth. So that's one point. But then income, the next item in the accounting, is much more equally distributed than say financial capital. But then consumption, you know, you can only wear one pair of pants at a time. You can have like Saddam Hussein 12 palaces, but you can only live in one palace at a time, and indeed in only one room at a time. So the as in your terminology, the consumptive equality is much greater than income. And then I think the most important point is that basic or necessary or important consumption is much more equally distributed. My friend Don Boudreau points out John D. Rockefeller didn't have access to pills to help with any depression he might have, whereas the poorest person in the United States can go get a pill if he's got clinical depression, and it actually helps. So, yeah, there's much more equality than people think. Significant equality, equality of things that actually matter. I mean, you know, I don't want to get sappy about this. You can say, oh, yeah, the sunsets are free and so forth. And yeah, okay. But look, express it this way. The world was much more unequal in 1800 than it is now. If you want to see inequality, go to the pre-innovism societies where the guys with the swords and the land were vastly better off than ordinary folks. And so I would make the argument that this capitalism that we keep falling into calling it has made the societies less unequal than they were before.
Yeah. Well, you know, when you look at pre-innovism, I like that. Innovism, it rolls off the tongue a little less better than capitalism, but it works. Pre-innovism, you know, that's when the scriptures were written. And it makes me wonder if the time frame that the scriptures were written in were different and it was post-innovism, would Jesus's admonitions to the wealthy and, you know, warnings about having too much wealth be different? Because, you know, it was a different, you acquired wealth in different ways, and in the acquisition of wealth, it very well could be a zero-sum situation, whereas now it's not.
Indeed. You're exactly right. Up to 1800, the zero-sum assumption was not such a bad one. Made a lot of sense.
Yeah.
Whereas it makes really very little sense now. Because this innovistic society has been gigantically positive sum. And that takes away a lot of sins. There was, of course, a change, another attitudinal change in the 17th and 18th centuries, moving away from a conception of poverty as inconsequential because you'll get pie in the sky when you die, that you should take up your cross in this life because you have an infinite life of glory if you suffer in this life. And that idea was really challenged in the 19th century with people saying, no, we've got to make people better off now. And I don't quite understand how that fits in, but it is a very important ideological change in Christianity.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think it was Dallas Willard who said that the whole point of the gospel is not to go to heaven when after you die, but to get to heaven before you die.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of...
Yeah, but that's a very sophisticated modern view. I'm not so sure it was prevalent in the Middle Ages.
Yeah, for sure. I recently have been posting on our Facebook page for Libertarian Christian Institute some work from humanprogress.org about poverty. And, you know, we've talked here in this conversation about the hockey stick graph where, you know, we've gone so high in productivity and wealth as a world. People don't know how much poverty is being reduced. And there are a lot of people predicting that, you know, absolute poverty, which I think is the below $1.90 a day level of poverty, will be abolished within our lifetime.
Yes.
Or in the next decade or so. Is, you know, obviously, if you set the bar at some level, you can probably reach it. I mean, we could set the bar at $5 a day, and that we'll probably still reach that in the next 100 years. Somebody quoted Jesus said, the poor will always be with you. And I'm like, I don't think that's what Jesus is trying to make a universal statement about.
Yeah.
But I mean, are you optimistic? Do you think capitalism will end poverty?
Oh, yes. And in fact, it already has. And those who are informed, like Hans Rosling and so forth, we all recognize it. There was a book by an Oxford economist, forget his name right away, but called The Bottom Billion. And he pointed out that in 1960, population was about 5 billion people, and 4 billion of those were in this absolute poverty. And now we have 7 billion people, and only 1 billion are still in this absolute poverty. And, you know, we need to worry about this bottom billion, but that's a massive transformation. And it's happened basically by allowing people to open businesses and make innovations. And the innovations don't have to be fancy. They can be just the innovation of moving to a new job and so forth, or getting some extra qualifications by going to school or an apprenticeship. That's how the world gets rich, and it's well on its way to getting rich. I don't think it's the next century that we're going to get to $5 a day. I think it's in the next half century, perhaps.
Yeah.
It'll be way, in fact, it'll be way above $5 a day. I reckon, as I said, the average now in the world is about $30 a day. And that is the income per person of Brazil. So think of Brazil as kind of the median country in the world. In a few weeks, I'm going to go to Brazil, a country that I love very much. I reckon that it would take about 20 years for Brazil to increase its income by a factor of 2. Then it gets up to the level of, say, Poland. And then another 20 years, and it's up to the level of what the United States is now. As I said before, I think sub-Saharan Africa is on the way out of absolute poverty. So I'm very optimistic. Now, optimism doesn't sell. If you want to write a best-selling book, tell people that the world is coming to an end. People love to read these books. My friend Bob Gordon did one a couple of years ago, said, oh, innovation is declining. And then I said to Bob, look, it's not declining in India. He said, oh, I don't care. It's declining in the United States. That's terrible. And Paul Ehrlich in 1968 or 7 or whenever it was said, by now we'd all be starving and fighting for bread in the streets. And now India is a grain exporter. Whereas in 67, it was a massive grain importer. So,
well, maybe all their scare tactics, it just made us want to be more innovative, and that's what made it.
No, I don't think so. I think people just get depressed when they think, oh my God. You know, there's a wonderful passage in, I think it's St. Paul's, maybe it's to the Ephesians or something. And he's saying, look, when I was with you, I worked very hard morning to night. I think he was washing the dishes or something. I worked all the time. I've heard that you people aren't working. And of course, the reason they weren't working is they expected the Messiah to come back at any moment. You know, this is the middle of the first century, these original Christian communities. And he said, someone who doesn't work shouldn't eat. I don't know why I brought that up exactly, except to say that this gloom that people have is very demoralizing. It means that people stop working and say, what the hell? It's just so damn silly. But people love to hear that the world is about to collapse.
Yeah, you're right. I mean, good news, which is ironic because that's what the gospel is. Good news doesn't write headlines. People like the doom and gloom because it gets your attention. You know, it's
poverty pornography. That's what it is. It's this delight that people have in hearing that things are going from bad to worse.
Yeah, well, I think the task before us as libertarians and as Christians would be to let people know that the world is getting, I mean, libertarians do this pretty well. It's like, hey, yes. look at the world. The crime rate is dropping dramatically, yeah. Despite the news. You know, people are rising out of poverty. You know, like yeah. 30,000 people rose out of poverty today, you know, yeah, statistically. Yeah. You know, there's a lot to complain about. And those things should be attended to, but it's not a doom and gloom situation.
It certainly isn't. And yet it's in the interest of the worst kind of people in politics like Donald Trump to scare us. That's what he's trying to do in the run-up to the congressional elections. Just one fearful thing after another. Now it's this march of these poor people from Central America that he's demonizing.
Yeah. I don't even know. That's a whole other conversation. This is like, we got to find somebody to scapegoat to make us scared of something that's probably not even bad for us.
It's the biblical meaning of scapegoating.
Yeah. Yeah, it is. Well, I think you use this phrase, if we keep our wits about us, we can prevail and it'll go better.
I think we can.
So what's on the horizon for you? I know you at least have one book with Art Carden, The Bourgeois Deal.
Yes. Art and I are almost finished with that book. And we hope that Chicago will publish it, and if not, someone else. And then I've got a book which I'm working on right now, which I'm going to try to get into Yale University Press in the next couple of weeks. It's called How to Be a Humane Libertarian, Essays in a New Liberalism. And it's got a long introductory section of about 80 pages. And then it's got a lot of my articles, my short opinion pieces arranged artfully. And it's meant to try to persuade people to a libertarian, a humane, a Christian libertarian view. Although in the first page, I say, let's reclaim the word liberal. Our friends on the left are frightened by it because the conservatives had made it into a swear word. So they are willing to be called progressives. And if they don't mind it being associated with compulsory sterilization, fine, they can have that. And we can claim back the word that we should have, which is liberal.
I'm in favor of that.
John Stuart Mill, Bastiat, Smith, et cetera, et cetera.
Well, and if you explain to liberty-loving conservatives what the word liberal means, or if you say, I'm against illiberal institutions or something like that, they'll be like, well, what do you mean? And then you explain it. They're like, oh, well, yeah, I'm for that too.
Yeah, and I think most Americans are. I think our friends, and I do have friends on the left and right, I think they'll get it. That at root, it means a society composed of non-slaves.
Yeah.
If you had to put it in one phrase, it would be that.
Well, thank you for being with us to talk about a million things, but things very important to Christian libertarians and to libertarians. And I hope to more Christians than just Christian libertarians. And I really appreciate your insight, your input, the work you've done in promoting the good news of capitalism.
Indeed.
It's super important and critical. And it's, I don't know, I'm a libertarian for the poor.
Yeah, I am too. That's all I'm interested in is the poor.
Yeah. So thanks for joining us.
Okay, dear, it's been interesting and fun.
Thank you for listening to another episode of the Libertarian Christian Podcast. If you like today's episode, we encourage you to rate us on Apple Podcasts to help expand our audience. If you want to reach out to us, email us at podcast@libertarianchristians.com. You can also reach us at LCI Official on Twitter. And of course, we are on Facebook and have an active group you are welcome to join. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.
The Libertarian Christian Podcast is a project of the Libertarian Christian Institute, a registered 501c3 nonprofit. If you'd like to find out more about LCI, visit us on the web at libertarianchristians.com. The voiceovers are by Matt Bellis and Catherine Williams. As of episode 115, our audio production is provided by Podsworth Media. Check them out at podsworth.com.